Good morning. Welcome to the Sunday, July 31st, 2016 edition of Waking Up, Freeing Ourselves from Work. Quote, the utopian attempt to realize an ideal state using a blueprint of society as a whole is one which demands a strong, centralized rule of a few, and which therefore is likely to lead to a dictatorship. This I consider a criticism of the utopian approach, for I have tried to show in the chapter on the principle of leadership that an authoritarian rule is a most objectionable form of government. There are even more direct arguments against the utopian approach. One of the difficulties faced by a benevolent dictator is to find whether the effects of his measures agree with his good intentions, as de Tocqueville saw clearly more than 100 years ago. The difficulty arises out of the fact that authoritarianism must discourage criticism. Accordingly, the benevolent dictator will not easily hear of complaints concerning the measures he has taken. But without some such check, he can hardly find out whether his measures achieve the desired benevolent aim. The situation must become even worse for the utopian engineer. The reconstruction of society is a big undertaking, which must cause considerable inconvenience to many, and for a considerable span of time. Accordingly, the utopian engineer will have to be deaf to many complaints. In fact, it will be part of his business to suppress unreasonable objections. He will say, like Lenin, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. But with it, he must invariably suppress reasonable criticism also. And that's unquote from Karl Popper's The Open Society and Its Enemies, Volume 1, The Spell of Plato. Sisters and brothers, bad is the world, and all will come to naught when such ill-dealing must be seen in thought, which means observed, but not referred to. And that's William Shakespeare from Richard III, Act 3, Scene 6. Last week, we asked, do we see the fascist intent behind a global system of class? Each day brings us ever stronger affirmative answers to this question. Fewer and fewer of us can pretend not to see it. Fewer and fewer of us want to waste our time trying to untangle the lies of the power guys in their political theater. At this point, it's a moot question what percentage of letters to the editor, news stories written, online posts, and screams of attendees at rallies are the work of power's operatives out to try to craft opinion. I wonder if Bernie Sanders really believed that his most vociferous supporters were authentic. When Shakespeare says that all will come to naught, he's talking about the lies of the power guys, the function of which is propagandistic. The objective for power is to replace our thoughts with their own, a preemptive silencing, which power's strategists, like Bentham, advised from the standpoint of energy efficiency. All will come to naught means the lies can't stand up, but it means more than just this. And I find I keep pondering it. I'm certain Nicola could offer the clearest explanation. He is the scientist alter to Shakespeare's artist. But they both took human energy to be at base their subject. So what is its state? Human energies, when it observes, takes note, and seemingly does nothing, and yet this nothing resolves the lies to naught. Has this not been our state, we commoners, observing, yet silenced, for millennia? Is this not also Langston Hughes' question, what happens to a dream deferred, but expressed in Nicola's terms? We've been worrying and worrying and worrying this problem for 10,000 years and more. A whole lot of thought has been devoted to it. It's not surprising that we have now figured it out, and that beneath the surface of our apparent suppression, much is happening. What do we call this energy of happening, and how do we bring it forth to consciousness and so to its manifestation in action? And because power compels our silence, there's an energy, consequence, effect on both sides. What is it? Karl Popper's point is well taken. The rulers cannot fix in place. And indisputably, there's nothing natural about class. It is pounded into our social arrangements by force, the most effective form of which being simply the totalitarian structure of society itself, as Bentham said. The rulers cannot fix in place a pattern without silencing the objectors. And we should take a second to get clear on who is and who is not an objector, i.e., who is and is not a threat to the achievement of power's ambitions. These totalitarian, utopian, social engineers, the Plato's tribesmen. A designation, objector, that shifts as the winds and tides of fortune turn, or in this case, as our understanding expands in one generation, is warred upon by power, using whatever weapons it happens to have in its arsenal, squelched, then recrafted into a form or version that's no longer threatening, because it's made to seem like a gift to us from the rulers themselves. For example, the power-fed media has now changed its tone in writing about gays, transgendered, black folks, and ex-cons. But that we are powerful, the source of all invention, that we absolutely don't need rulers, leaders, statesmen, or whatever you may want to call them, is a message they refuse to allow us to give to each other. And so then our oppositional messages are finally absorbed into the structure of class, of power itself, neutralized, denuded of authentic power, made safe and commercialized. This is the part where they sell our acts of revolt back to us, i.e., make money on our resistance to demonstrate that they are everything, that there is no escape. So let's tease out from this, what artist, what message is and is not a threat? To acknowledge that we are effectively all slaves in this system is the most radical message from the perspective of power. To dismiss vocally all the rationalizations for this situation, for example, progress, is the most radical message. To state baldly that the set of circumstances called class is not natural or necessary, that it is imposed by force by those with the power to do so, is the most radical message. To state that this reality, based on scarcity and artificially created and maintained hierarchy, is the work of the minuscule few, 0.000 of the world population, in order to maintain their privilege atop a global system of class, is the most radical message. To say that decision-making by and for the few is wrong, that decision-making is the province of all, as leadership is the capacity of all and must not be hoarded, is the most radical message. To suggest that we are born with the most important things to know, and that the system robs us of them, is the most radical message. Of course, there should be nothing radical about being what you are. These guys have criminalized, using their hidden law, as Plato advised, being fully alive. Putting on your tongue or in writing any of these messages, if you are consistent, and determined to voice them will get you targeted. If you can popularize these messages appealingly and charismatically and model resistance to the imposition of the false self, if you encourage others to follow you into disobedience, as did Prince, you will get targeted all the faster and with a maximum degree of viciousness. If you talk about the violent overthrow of the system, you will be encouraged, if not outright recompensed, in various ways and to varying extents.